The Bob Murphy Show, episode 37.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everybody to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. With this particular episode, I'm going to be starting a series, because it's going to be more of a theme, a recurring theme in the Bob Murphy Show, where we're going to talk a lot about healthcare economics, but also solutions, right? So it's not just going to be me having guests on to abstractly outline, here's the problem, here's what's screwing up medicine in the United States or health insurance or whatever the particular issue is, and these are the 16 government policies that need to change. Moving on. That's not what we're doing here. The reason I'm really excited about this is, sure, we can get intellectual and esoteric and explain the abstract problems and give the history of how do we get here and talk about the long-run solutions and how government policies would need to change and what would a free market in medicine really look like. We can do all that, and we will. Don't misunderstand. We will do all that. But in addition, I'm going to have guests on who are going to show you how you can take steps right away in the real world to shield yourself from the worst problems of this system, because I think things are just going to get worse. And it's sort of dovetails with what I'm doing with Carlos Lahr, for those of you who follow the Lahr Murphy Show on the financial side, where we are showing people how to effectively secede from the standard Wall Street commercial bank retirement fund nexus that the conventional wisdom puts you into. Likewise, here, there's a big net that grabs most Americans, and, oh, you got to get health insurance from your employer, and then you go, and that covers everything, and you stay in network, and you never actually pay anything, and it's not real money. And how do you break out of that system? And you have doctors and patients who are just contracting around it, and they're treating it like it's a business. So I'm really excited about this, that I think this is an area where it actually matters. If you know what's going on and the fact that you've read up on Austrian economics, it's actually going to do something useful in your life. Imagine that. So my guest right now to kick off this new trend or theme that you're going to see on the show is Dr. Keith Smith. He's an anesthesiologist. That's a hard word to say. He's the founder of what's called the Surgery Center of Oklahoma and also the Free Market Medical Association. And we will talk about those things at great length in the actual interview. And I think you guys are going to like this, that Dr. Smith is very knowledgeable. How I know him is Jeff Deist was a mutual friend, and Dr. Smith's Free Market Medical Association recently had, it was back in April, we're talking 2019 now, had their conference in Dallas. So with me being out in Lubbock, it wasn't that hard to get out there. I gave a presentation on sort of the free market economics of healthcare. And the keynote for that luncheon meeting was Dr. Ron Paul. So that was kind of nice. So anyway, I was very impressed with the turnout. These were not just ideological people who were there because they wanted to hear someone rant about the government. Rather, they were serious professionals from all walks of life, but all different sectors or areas in the healthcare sector, whether on the insurance side, dealing with getting employers and how do you provide coverage for your employees? Is there maybe a way to do it without going through the conventional route? Doctors who are, running cash only practices, all that stuff was there. And so it was very encouraging. It was sort of like when I first went to a Bitcoin conference and I realized, wow, they're not just sitting around moping. They're actually kind of trying to come up with, how are we going to deal with this system? What are some solutions? And that's what this conference, it had that feel to it. So I really liked it. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Keith Smith. Well, Dr. Keith Smith, it's a pleasure to have you here on the Bob Murphy Show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be with you.
So as I told the listeners in the introduction here to this episode, I'm going to spend sometime over the coming months here interviewing people affiliated with what is called the Free Market Medical Association. So that's probably a logical place to start. Can you explain to the listeners what is the Free Market Medical Association?
Yes, the Free Market Medical Association is a group that was founded by my friend Jake Hempton and I with the idea that we could promote the principles of the free market as we understand them to help others in the medical industrial complex mend their ways and begin dealing in market exchanges the way everybody else does. So the organization is, unlike a lot of medical organizations, not so full of doctors. It's full of people in the industry, real insiders that have watched this sausage made for a long time, and they know what's wrong, and they know who's responsible, and many of them know how to fix it, and many of them represent huge buying power, just an unbelievable consumer power that ultimately we think will change things. So when Jay Kempton and I met, he liked that I would tell him how much a surgery costs, and I liked that he would pay me on behalf of his self-funded clients, so that it felt like a cash transaction. But we decided rather than keep each other a secret, we would help others and teach others really to act and coordinate buying and selling of medical services in the same way Jay and I had experienced work so well. So the Free Market Medical Association is a large association now with 37 state chapters. There are a lot of physicians and facilities that are to some degree exhibiting price transparency, either posting all their prices online for everyone to see like we do at Surgery Center of Oklahoma, or some degree of that where you can just call them and ask them, how much is a hernia repair, how much is an MRI, and they'll tell you over the phone. So that's the nature of the organization.
Yeah, and this is something, if you could just take a minute on this point, I had jotted down notes before talking to you, Keith, here about, what should we cover? And this is something that it happened to me recently. I mentioned this when I gave the talk, at your recent conference, where I had to, I was interested in a routine blood test. I was curious about something. And I called, when I mentioned to my doc, called up my doctor and had him schedule it. And then when his person got back to me and said, okay, we've scheduled it for such and such. And I was at Texas Tech University at the time. And, so I was going to their facilities. And the person said to me something like, we're not certain that your insurance is going to cover it. So before you go do this, you might want to first check and see how much it is and blah, blah. And I had to call three separate people and nobody could tell me how much this test was going to cost. And they were all, they were all perfectly pleasant. They weren't being evasive. They just truly didn't know. And not only didn't they know, they didn't even know how it could be known. And finally, the last lady, the one who was sort of the last line in the chain there said something like, well, a lot of these go through and I see the, the bills we send to the insurance. I don't think it's going to be that much. And I said, okay. And then she said, it wouldn't be more than, $500, which, that's kind of a lot. And it turned out it was like 200 or something and the insurance covered a bunch of it. So it wasn't a big deal. But my point was, as an economist, like looking at that, can you imagine if any other market was like if you had to go buy a new car and you called a bunch of the car dealerships and they literally wouldn't tell you the price until after you purchased the car? I mean, clearly that would not work. And for sure, we wouldn't call that a free market in cars. And yet people have this idea that the reason there's problems in U.S. medicine is because we have too much capitalism involved.
Yeah. And to some extent, medical procedures and tests and the delivery of medical services cannot be commoditized. There is a small amount of uncertainty that is real. And so there are two groups of people that are answering the phone when you call and ask how much. Some of them don't know. Some of them don't know what they can get away with. So I don't know how much it is. Might be an honest answer, but more than likely the answer is, well, I know, but I'm not going to tell you because I don't know how much I can get away with here. I need to ensure that I maximize my revenue rather than reveal my fair pricing and be judged by the market. So while there is an uncertainty that's attached to medical service delivery, it's not necessarily associated with the purchase of all commoditized goods. It is almost, there's not nearly as much uncertainty as people would like to claim there is. And that's what they hide behind when they say, I don't know. Because what they really mean is, I don't know how much money I can get out of you. You know, show me your card. You know, show me what insurance plan you're with, and so I can see how much revenue I can extract from this exchange.
Oh, that's really interesting. Even though, as you're saying that now, it's obvious, that really hadn't occurred to me. I just figured it was a standard policy because, yeah, like you say, because I had heard a similar thing when I was doing research for my book, The Primal Prescription, with Doug McGuff. I was doing research for that and came across there was some news anchor somewhere, I think she's in Philadelphia or something, and she was pregnant, and as part of just a story for, you know, healthcare costs in America, that kind of thing, she had called around to hospitals and nobody would give her a straight, I think one place gave her an answer, and even then they were saying, hey, this is not a quote, you know, other things could go wrong, and there you yeah, and so there the official reasoning was, well, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen and we don't want to give you one number, and then if it's more expensive, you come later and, you know, say we lied to you. But yeah, I see what you're saying. The answer is because there is no set price. It depends who the buyer is. Then the price changes.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, how much should give you an answer 90%+ of the time for those conditions and procedures to which there is attached a certain amount of uncertainty. My God, that's what we have insurance for. The problem is these companies that are called insurance companies are not in the insurance business. They're in the business of skimming the transaction, extracting a toll every time anyone receives, just like you did, a blood test. And that's not what insurance is for. It's not for an oil change or a tune-up or new tires. And in the medical industry, that's what's obtained.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I do want to come back to that. But before we lose the train here, so the Free Market Medical Association, even though it might sound like, oh, it's this sort of wonkish institute that just pushed out periodical white papers on, you know, how drug price or whatever, how the FDA should be reformed. It's actually, it's a practical real world thing for right now, even given the legal and regulatory constraints, how real world physicians and other medical professionals can try to move away from this third-party payment system and just get back to the medicine is a business?
That's correct. And the Free Market Medical Association was named with a lot of thought. My study of the free market has, and very early on, ended up right in the Austrian camp. And I'm no economist. I would never enter into a serious discussion about economics, but I am a student, and all of the Austrian writings that I've read make sense. And so when we talked about naming this association, we wanted to call it, you know, something that was accurate, that really did represent what we believed. The Free Market Medical Association made sense. And in my mind, I consider it almost a medical service extension and manifestation of the Austrian concepts that I've come across. And one of the ways that has kept us focused is, unlike a lot of medical organizations, the idea that the government can be involved as a helper in any way is seen as ludicrous. The only way we could see the government involved in promoting free markets would be for them to rescind every single thing they've ever done that's disturbed the market. So we really do consider ourselves consistent with, I think, the teachings of the disciples of the Austrian school. And if in some way we are not, I would welcome anyone's critique to the extent that we are not, because that's certainly our intention.
Well, great. So we just could pursue this a little bit here. So what you, those of the professionals in your network, and certainly what you're doing, and I talked to some other people when I was at your conference recently who are doing this. Let me give the layman's version, and then you can refine it. But part of the reason, quote, healthcare costs are so astronomical is there's these third-party payers, and the hospital or the doctor's office knows they're going to throw out some number a bunch of the patients aren't ever going to pay a cent. Some of the other ones are going to pay, but it's going to get discounted through various measures of arguing with the insurance companies or with Medicare. And then even then, it's only going to be paid months down the road. And you got to have a whole support staff who don't specialize in taking blood pressure, but they just specialize in harassing people to pay or dealing with the insurance company. So if you are as a practice, as a doctor, move away from that and you just have clients who just pay you cash, that gets rid of a lot of overhead. And so you can afford to pass savings on to them. Is that the premise?
That's correct. From the physician's viewpoint, that is exactly right. And the manifestation of that approach now is referred to by many as the direct primary care movement, where patients and physicians just deal directly and there are no intermediaries whatsoever in that exchange. From the institutional side, like a hospital or a surgery center or an imaging facility, the reason the fees and the prices and the charges are so high is partly due to the burden that is imposed on them, the regulatory burden. But keep in mind, this regulatory burden is the work product of the large hospital systems who are big enough to deal with this regulatory burden. And they know that their smaller competitors are not able to deal with this regulatory burden. So it makes the smaller players easier to take over. There are other more complicated reasons that the hospital charges are so high. One is that the hospitals issue these gigantic bills knowing they're not going to collect that amount and knowing that some discount will be applied by one of the insurance carriers. But then they write off the amount of that giant charge they did not collect as a loss. And it turns out these big hospital systems need all of the red ink that they could possibly find to maintain the fiction of their not-for-profit status. Now, most of these big hospital systems just don't pay tax. And when people see not-for-profit, they think altruism and all these wonderful things. All it just means is they don't pay tax. They don't pay property tax. They don't pay any tax. And to shelter the huge profits that they generate, they need all of this red ink to maintain this fiction. The other thing that happens is these losses the hospitals claim to have incurred, they are all put in a bucket and shipped off to DC and come back as a kickback in the form of what's referred to as a disproportionate share hospital payment. So Uncle Sam pads Medicare payments to hospitals that claim these huge losses. So there's a lot of shell game and money changing going on. And the reason these charges are so high many times, it's all behind the curtain and hard for people to see.
Okay, well, yeah, that's really interesting. So I guess, why don't we adopt it from the perspective here of a typical patient? I guess that you would be advising them that, hey, you might want to seriously consider going and finding, like, would they go to your website and try to find a doctor near them who participates in your organization? Is that how it would work?
Yes, they could go to Surgery Center of Oklahoma's website. They could, if they live in this area or anywhere nearby, or they could go to the Free Market Medical Association's website. There's a tab there called Shop Health, and that will help them find a cash price at a facility probably near them if they want to buy their care instead of funnel it through the mess. The other thing I recommend people do is consider contracting with a direct primary care doctor. Those physicians can most easily be found at a website called dpcfrontier.com. And that shows a map of the United States, and there is a dot, wherever there is one of these practices, and the map is almost completely covered now with dots. Physicians that are fed up with the current system and know how broken it is and have been burnt out or victimized by it, and they're walking away, and they're opening these practices, these direct primary care practices. And the reason I encourage people to consider that, the price for which I think is about $70 a month average in the United States, that'll give you unlimited access to a primary care doctor. The real value, though, is if you go see an independent physician under one of these arrangement umbrellas, they are not under the gun to refer you up the sausage tube to their hospital employer to inflict very expensive and possibly damaging testing on you in order to maintain their viability as an employee of a big hospital system. So I encourage anyone who feels like they may have any sort of primary care needs whatsoever to fire whoever their doctor is and go seek out one of these direct primary care doctors who will not only be their medical advocate, but will also be their financial advocate and their quality advocate. Make sure that the surgeon they refer you to, for instance, is the surgeon that would remove their gallbladder or take their, repair their hernia. So the primary care part of this is a very important and very disruptive component of this free market movement. So people can search and find direct primary care doctors very easily. They can search surgical and imaging procedures very easily on the FMMA website. And then just keep your eyes open. And I recommend people go to their local hospital and say, I carry a price list from the FMMA Health tab or the Surgery Center of Oklahoma. Carry that price list in and say, I need a hernia repair. And I'd really like for you to match this so I don't have to fly to Oklahoma. And if you won't, I will. And we received numerous emails from patients that will say, you saved us tens of thousands of dollars by allowing us to leverage a better deal in our local market. And we saved all this money and you didn't even perform the surgery. So the market is vibrant. It's alive and well. I think the big hospital players do not want to admit how vibrant this market is. I think you saw it. You saw it at the meeting in Dallas.
Oh, it definitely. Yeah. So again, I mentioned this in the introduction, folks, but yeah, I was one of the speakers at an FMMA event recently here in Dallas. The keynote speaker was Dr. Ron Paul. And yeah, I was really blown away, Keith, by the turnout you had and to realize that this is a real thing. This isn't just a bunch of, academics sitting around dreaming about. Imagine what a better society with, smaller government would look like. I mean, these were people in the real world doing, and that's why it was so exciting. I don't know if you have any of these numbers at your fingertips, Keith, but do you have, for someone who's never heard of this before, just to give them a ballpark frame of reference, like, you don't just mean, oh yeah, you might save 10% on your medical expenses. I mean, these are some huge savings that are being achieved.
Yes. We put our prices online at Surgery Center of Oklahoma a little over 10 years ago, before there was any demand that we could perceive for doing that. And so the only way I really knew how my prices compared was to ask patients who did come see us, did you shop around and what was your next best price? And we had seen some hospital bills through the years that were, anywhere from 8 to 12 times what we found we could fairly charge for any given procedure. But over time, those ratios have been borne out where any patient that comes to our facility that travels, to have their surgery at our place, knowing what our price is, will report anywhere from 6 to 10x what I have listed online. And so this is a 90% savings, and that's not infrequent. We had a patient from Georgia years ago who had heard about our facility, and we had a procedure listed online that his urologist had told him he required, and our online price was $3,600, but he had been quoted at his local hospital $40,000. And he told his urologist he was coming to Oklahoma City, and the urologist had lost another patient to us for this very same reason. And he said, no, we're going to go talk to the hospital. So they went into the administration and told them what the deal was. And the administrator said, well, we'll do it for $4,000. So, this is a guy that saved whatever that is. I mean, that's almost 90% on that one procedure. So yeah, the savings is it's shocking. And people frequently ask us, how do you do this so cheaply? And so, turn turn your camera around the other way. Why are they charging so much? And it's because they get all that they can get away with most of the time.
So, and I've seen enough of this, you know, to know that what you're speaking is correct. If I'm trying to get the heart of what's driving this, because normally, you know, if it were a largely free market, and that's probably the issue here, is that the normal market forces of competition are being crippled by government intervention, and maybe that's what we can try to figure out what's going on here. But normally you would think, wait a minute, if there's some firm in Oklahoma that's charging $3,600 or $4,000 for this procedure, and some other place is charging $40,000, why are the insurance companies, you know, agreeing to that? Why don't the insurance companies say to that one hospital, what are you kidding me? We know that this procedure really only costs $4,000. We're not going to pay you $40,000 for that. So why isn't that, you know, like if in car insurance, if some auto shop was charging 10 times as much to replace your windshield as the guy down the street, you would think that your, you know, the auto insurance companies at the very least would step in and say, that's crazy. We're not paying that. So what is it specifically that's preventing that kind of competition? Why is this hospital getting anybody to pay $40,000? I guess that's what I'm getting at.
Well, in this situation, the hospital and the insurance carrier are working together, and they, you know, they scratch each other's back. So the way it works, the hospital throws out a $40,000 bill. The insurance company rides in on their white horse and discounts that $40,000 bill to say $10,000, and then they typically would ride into an employer's office, you know, on this white horse and say, look here, you know, we're the big bad insurance company. And thanks to us, you know, we achieved a $30,000 discount. Look at all the money we've saved you. All the while, the employer does not know that what the hospital really was paid was probably $8,000. And the insurance company pocketed part of this discount that they falsely achieved. So it's a situation where the insurance companies are peddling and skimming from discounts that they claim that they achieve. The hospitals will tell the insurance companies, you know, this, we will give you pretty reasonable pricing, even though it's multiples of what Surgery Center of Oklahoma charges. And in return, you know, we will give you these gigantic charges that then you can go play with in the discount market. And then you must agree then not to contract with our lower price competitors. And so when I refer to them as a cartel, that's exactly what it is. The hospitals provide pricing to the big insurance carriers with the understanding that the carriers will not contract with lower price competitors. And then the hospitals or the insurance carriers benefit from this arrangement because the higher the initial charge, the more money they make. So I've been told that it's not uncommon for an insurance exec to actually ask a hospital administrator, can you do a brother a favor and double that charge? Because that maximizes the opportunity that they have to make money off of this discount. With all of my prices online, you know, this discount thing is an opportunity foregone. I mean, there is no way that anybody would get away applying a discount to my fee, which is listed online.
Right. I see that. So that's very interesting. So part of it, I guess, is, as you're saying, because that initial sticker price is so high, the average person seeing that just files away as a fact of life. You absolutely need to have health insurance coverage, because otherwise, if you had got rushed to the emergency room or, you know, you had something go wrong, you'd be bankrupted. No normal person could possibly pay these numbers. You need to be in the bosom of this benevolent insurance company, and they'll go to bat for me. They'll stand up to those evil hospitals,
right?
Because you know, it's like being part of a union or something.
They do, and they manufacture a lot of fear. You're exactly right. They manufacture a lot of fear with these gigantic charges. And so there are two groups of buyers. There are the buyers who actually care what stuff costs, and they have sticker shock. And then there's another group of buyers that really don't care what it costs, and nobody even cares what. You ask anybody that's had their appendix out or had their tonsils taken out, how much was it? And they'll tell you their copay and deductible. They don't have any idea how much it costs. And frankly, most people don't care beyond what it actually costs them out of pocket. When we put our prices online, and everybody else has had the same experience, there's a group of buyers who actually care what it costs. And so they're the only consumers really in the market because they have that sticker shock that's absent from much of the market because of this intermediary that's skimming the exchange.
So I suppose, I mean, just thinking off the cuff here, like in terms of what is it that, because again, like in a genuine free market, you would think even if there were these cozy relationships, competition would eventually break them down. But here it's not an open market. And so like somebody can't just down the street open up a competing hospital because there's all kinds of, was it like certificate of need or something like that, that the other doctors in the area can just have to sign off on. And of course, there's the FDA and the, you know, the medical licensing. So there's all kinds of restrictions politically on, you know, competition in this sector. So I guess, is that partly what maintains this crazy relationship?
Yes, absolutely. There's still certificate of need laws in, I think, 30 states or more. There also was a provision in the Unaffordable Care Act that was the last item optioned to the American Hospital Association to gain their support for that legislation. And it is a clause that prevents the construction of a new physician-owned hospital and even the expansion of an existing physician-owned hospital. And the government does what it always does. It says, well, you can go ahead if you want. You just can't accept any federal money. So it was very stifling for this legislation to appear, particularly that part of it. So there's certificate of need. There's the federal prohibition on the construction or expansion of physician-owned facilities. And then the regulatory burden that typically only the largest institutions can endure is very scary and creates a lot of uncertainty for anybody that's contemplating stepping out as an underdog. And the other thing is that if you step in as an underdog, you very likely are not going to be allowed in the club or the network, as the insurance companies call it. So to step into this game knowing that it's not so much that the market is dysfunctional, the market is absent. And you really have to understand who the buyers are with sticker shock and appeal to them. I think the good news is we're beginning to see this good old boy thing breaking down a bit because some parts of this arrangement have benefited more than others, and starting to see some finger pointing right now where, you know, there are all these surprise medical bills, and you know, the insurance companies want to blame the hospitals and the hospitals want to blame the insurance companies. And as my dad says, you know, there's some fights where you just sit back and hope for casualties on both sides. And I think there's a little bit of that going on. And so I think there is a breakdown. And I think also the insurance companies are very aware of the pricing that I have online, and many others do too. And that really has become their new benchmark for how they can leverage the big hospital systems. Because at some point, I think to your point, at some point it becomes worth it to walk away from the good old boy arrangement and for some of these carriers to actually get back into the insurance business. I'm actually very optimistic because I think I am seeing the breakdown that you would think that the power of the market would provide. And I think we are witnessing it right now.
Well, that's very encouraging. Let's go back. You made a couple of remarks in the beginning of this interview here that I want to follow up on, saying how, you know, like with car insurance, the function of insurance is that there's a small probability event that has a large financial cost, and that's what insurance is for. So yeah, if in case you get into an accident with your car and you need your car to be replaced, then that's what auto insurance is for. It is not for you to fill up your gas tank, to get your oil changed, to get new tires periodically. That's not what insurance is for. And if it were, then you know, your premiums for auto insurance would start rising and that sort of thing. Yet with healthcare, it's the other way around. With health, with what we call health insurance, it's not like that. And also, too, the fact that it's tied to your employer. And I use this line at the talk I gave at your organization, Keith, where I said, you know, if you asked your buddy, hey, do you want to go out on Friday? And he said, oh no, I can't drive. And I said, why not? He said, oh, because I'm in between jobs right now, so I don't have car insurance. Like, nobody talks like that. But yet plenty of people would say, oh, I'm not getting this elective procedure right now, the health procedure, because I'm in between jobs and I got to wait till I get health insurance. Like, people talk about it. So it's just weird about the nature of so-called health insurance. And so, I know we were talking before the interview where you made this point, and we said this too in the book Primal Prescription, that for some reason in U.S. politics, health care and health insurance have been conflated. Those are totally distinct things.
That's right. I don't know how many times people have told me, well, you know, I can't get my vitamin B12 shots anymore because Medicare won't cover it. I think, well, of course you can get vitamin B12 shots whether Medicare covers it or not. You just pay for it. People will say, well, there's not a doctor that's in my insurance network that I like that will take, you know, my child's tonsils out, so I guess they can't get their tonsils out. Well, no, you just go buy it. But people are really brainwashed, really. And it's very sheep-like, and the carriers have benefited from this. The big insurance carriers have definitely benefited from this. But so many people mistake health coverage from health care. Keep in mind, when we put our prices online, almost 11 years ago now, the first patients that arrived were Canadians, and they all have coverage. Now, they just don't have access to the care so many of them require. The most common story was a woman with painful or dysfunctional uterine bleeding that needed a hysterectomy, and she was in a 3-year waiting line to see a gynecologist and was tired of receiving transfusions. So they would pay the $8,000 that I have listed online, which is surgeon, anesthesia, facility, pathology, and a one-night stay in our facility. And they would pay that $8,000, you know, to have their surgery and get their cure. So there are a lot of people that have coverage. They just don't have access to the care that they require.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an elementary point, but it's worth emphasizing that, you know, just because the government snaps their fingers and says, now everyone, you know, it's illegal for an insurance carrier to deny coverage to people, that doesn't increase the number of doctors or the number of MRI machines. And it's just shocking to me how people just think that, oh yeah, because they passed a law, that means now everyone's going to get the same medical care that Warren Buffett gets. I mean, that's just amazing to me.
Yeah, they'll just see a different type of rationing. And the type of rationing that governments do in government healthcare systems tends to be much more cruel and deadly. And the market is honest about rationing. There are limited resources, except when the market does it, they're used in the most efficient way, and so more people have access and to better care, I would argue. But yeah, the rationing that is occurring in the United Kingdom, in Canada, in many of the places that people, you know, say, oh, this is wonderful. You know, this is, you know, free healthcare, you know, universal healthcare for everyone. All of those countries are making a swing towards the free market because the failure is becoming increasingly intolerable. You know, one thing I'll add too, whenever I learned my lesson early on, whenever a Canadian came to our facility, you know, here they are in Oklahoma City, for God's sake. I mean, the system has failed them. They're paying cash and they come all the way to Oklahoma to have a hysterectomy. I mean, what else do you need to know about the failure of a socialized system? And so I wrongly assumed that you know, we would be kindred spirits in my critical remarks about the Canadian healthcare system. And I was very wrong at this. It's almost like nationalism. The pride that many people have, the Canadians, I would say in particular, in their national healthcare, it's a source of pride that it's unbelievable. I learned my lesson early on, and I'll never criticize the socialized medicine system that has so betrayed the patients that come to our facility. I won't do that again.
Well, that's interesting. So I work with the Fraser Institute, which is a free market, you know, economics think tank up in Canada there. And yeah, you're right. When it comes to healthcare issues, we have to be really sensitive, let's say. And I was briefed early on that saying, Bob, you got to understand that the average Canadian, they think it's the Wild West in the United States. They think it's like laissez-faire healthcare and people are dying in the streets, you know, because they have appendicitis and they don't have enough money. And it's, so one thing is the government at all levels in the U.S. actually spends the same fraction of GDP on healthcare in the U.S. as in Canada. It's just on top of that, there's all the private expenditures, but it's not the case that, the Canadian government's generous and takes care of healthcare and the U.S. government's stingy. It's that, no, the U.S. government spends just as much and then you got all the private spending on top of it. So I'm just curious, for those Canadians coming to you, did they just think they were a weird quirk that slipped through the cracks in their system? Or like, how could they reconcile their faith in their great system with the fact that, like you say, they're having to leave the country to get something taken care of?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. They think they're a weird quirk. You know, we have this safety net, but every net has holes in it. And I'm just one of those unfortunate people that fell through a hole, but there's all the rest of the net, you know, that is there for me if anything else goes wrong. It's sort of that sort of thinking.
Yeah, and I've also just anecdotally, I know a bunch of people in Canada where it's things like they want to get a hip replacement or knee, things where they can deal with it. It's just excruciating pain. And so then they're put on a really long waiting list. It's kind of like a triage that they do. And, you know, if you're about to die, maybe they'll deal with you first or something. Yeah. But yeah.
I tell people that that the one single payer that Canadians can truly rely on is themselves. And many of them have discovered that. Then they travel to the United States and other places to get their care because it's just not available up there many times.
Why don't I circle back here to something? Because again, I want to just, I'm sure a lot of the listeners, you know, now all of a sudden they're hopeful that, oh, wow, I knew healthcare was screwed up, but it looks like, you know, there's these innovators, these pioneers who are showing a new way. I could see the average person saying something like this, though. So just tell me, Keith, if they're missing something, they might say, look, I need to retain my health insurance coverage in case, you know, something really bad happens, some catastrophic incident. So I need to keep the coverage. So since I'm paying those premiums anyway, what do I care? Why don't I just go to a regular doctor since my insurance pays for it?
Yeah. And there are two ways to look at that. One is that most people now have deductibles that are more than the entire amount they would pay in cash if they were to buy their healthcare directly. So it's very unusual for people to actually meet their deductibles. Most people don't even meet their deductible during the year. We had a large national news group come spend the day with me 2 weeks ago, and that's what they were looking for. They said, do you have any patients on this particular Thursday that are traveling in from out of state who have insurance but elect not to use it? And we had four that day. So, you know, these people have either these Obamacare plans or they have a, you know, a Blue Cross plan with a $5,000 deductible or something like that. And I say, just come on in and leave that in the car. And, you know, and our cash price is a fraction of their deductible. And so then they gamble that the rest of the year will be a healthy experience for them and they don't meet their deductible. So there are instances where people actually have insurance where they still should shop around. Deductibles, as high as they are, were a gift to the big insurance carriers by the folks who wrote the Affordable Care Act. And that insulates the carriers from a lot of expense, but it created a consumer market. It's very unintended and inadvertent. But, you know, if you've got a $7,000 family deductible, you're a shopper.
Right. And also just on that point, that what happened with me. So this was when the Affordable Care Act passed, that was before my tech, you know, when I was a Texas Tech, obviously I was with their coverage, but before that I was self-employed. And so I, you know, was buying it over the counter, my own policy. And I had what was called a catastrophic plan, right? Because I'm pretty healthy. I barely ever have any medical expenses. And so I just was, you know, paying for the low premium and high deductible, one of those plans. And of course, that was ruled to be illegal under the Affordable Care Act, even though, you know, I liked my plan, but I couldn't keep it. And my premium went up, I'm ballparking here, but it went up about 50%. And so I had just assumed that, oh, that's because it's the, you know, the standard health benefits, and I'm going to have a much lower deductible now with the affordable, with the ACA approved plan with all these benefits and so on, because, you know, now I'm getting a bit. And no, my deductible actually went up.
Yep.
So not only did my premium go up by about 50%, my deductible even went up. And I guess the reason was because now if I got pregnant, that was covered, whereas my other plan didn't cover that for me. So it was really shocking that, like, it didn't, like, even on its own terms, it didn't do what they told people it was going to do.
That's right. And I think they knew that. The other reason everyone's expense went up, their deductibles and their premiums went up, was the pre-existing condition. So, you know, it's just like you wait until your house catches on fire and you pick up the phone and buy, you know, fire insurance for your home. It's the same thing. So everyone's expense went up. I was in the same boat, Bob. My plan was one that I liked. It was a catastrophic plan. I'd had it for 12 years. I had never filed a claim. I'd paid cash for everything as I went. It was just simply there as a, you know, a catastrophic safety net. And I never filed a claim because I didn't think it was any of their darn business what sort of health care I might be buying for me or my family. And so I chose to just purchase care. But of course, it was, like your plan, declared illegal and couldn't have that plan. The answer I give to people who say, well, you know, we're just going to go without insurance, you know, what kind of lunatic are you? The best answer out there, I think, are these cost-sharing ministries. And I belong to Christian Healthcare Ministries. And it actually costs me less than the old plan that I liked. And I frankly think it is more reliable and better coverage, even though it's technically not coverage. You just share other members' expense. So there is a way, there is a good way to get around this mess. One is to have a direct primary care doctor that you pay $70 a month and basically have concierge kind of care because of that, and then have a cost-sharing ministry of some kind sitting underneath you. And then what you wind up paying out of pocket is actually pretty reasonable.
Let's take a break, folks, for my interview with Dr. Keith Smith to talk about what else but my book, The Primal Prescription. So this is something that I co-authored with ER Dr. Doug McGuff, another medical professional who really knows free market economics. And I got to tell you, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good book. I wanted to, as I often do with these books intended for the general public, I just thought through what's all the great stuff I've read that had me understand and learn more about healthcare from a free market economics perspective over the years. And I tried to put it all in one spot for you. We give a nice history. How did the U.S. get to where it was on the eve of the Affordable Care Act? Why did it seem like the free market had failed in healthcare and health insurance? And then we talk extensively, analyze the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. And then we give solutions, ways that you can break out of that system. And so I think, I still think the book is very relevant. And so I would encourage you to check it out. So you can either just get the book directly, and I'll give a link in the show notes page. This is bobmurphyshow.com/37. If you want to find it on Amazon, or if you want to contribute to the Bob Murphy Show, and you can look at the details if you go through the link, you will see a way that you can get a signed copy of The Primal Prescription. That is at bobmurphyshow.com/contribute. Now back to my conversation with Dr. Keith Smith. I suppose another loose end, somebody might wonder and say, okay, I get what you're saying, Dr. Smith, you know, for the run-of-the-mill things, but in the rare case where I do have some, you know, major issue come up, how does that work? Does my direct primary care physician need to have relationships with all these specialists, and you know, do they all need to be part of the FMMA, or can they be just regular doctors? How does that work?
Yeah, and fortunately in the United States, there still are about half of the physicians in the country are independent of these big vicious price gouging hospital systems. So any primary care doctor is going to have relationships with the specialists that are needed. And you don't need a specialist to be some hardcore FMMA-er. You just need a specialist who's not part of a price gouging hospital. Because when the when the primary care doctor calls the surgeon and or the endocrinologist and says, hey, I've got a patient I want you to see, that in some ways the patient is the consumer and the customer of the surgeon. But in other ways, the primary care doctor is the consumer, and the surgeon is simply a consultant. And consultants live and die by whether people seek and buy their services. So, you know, a surgeon that receives referrals from a primary care doctor, he has accountability to that primary care doctor, or his phone will never ring again from that particular doctor. So it's yet another reason that people should seek out these independent primary care doctors, because the leverage they have over the specialists and how they treat patients, and not just medically but financially, is more profound than most people understand, I think.
Okay, why don't we switch the perspective of the employer? So I'm thinking the one group now of people listening who might be very intrigued are the employers who, up till they heard this interview, were thinking, "Ah, yeah, I'm glad Blue Cross is really going to bat for me, because I, you know, periodically, you know, look at their reports and my goodness, you know, especially if it's a large employer, legally they have to provide health insurance, or even a smaller one, that they might just do that because they know that's the way to attract quality employees, is to, you know, have quote good health insurance or health benefits." So, and now they're scratching their head and like realizing, wait a minute, maybe it's not like that. So is there some log jam in terms of like, why wouldn't an employer like maybe look into this, and would they try to switch and encourage their employees to go this route? Or I guess that's what I'm getting. Is this something that the individual employee has to do, or actually if the employer is on board, does that make this whole system easier?
Well, you're right about who the skeptics are at this point in the interview, that employers are either fully insured, where they pay premiums on behalf of the employees, and some insurance carrier assumes the risk and pays the claims. They don't really assume any risk. All they do is front the money and then inflict the damage on the employer the next year with premium increases. So it's just a matter of timing. A good friend of mine, a broker, David Contorno, says, insurance companies pay my health bills like my CPA pays my taxes. It's just, mm-hmm. I mean, that it's the same thing. The other group of employers are employers that have elected to pay for their employees' health needs out of operating revenue. And those arrangements are typically referred to as self-funded or self-insured. And then they'll buy big catastrophic sort of, you know, Lloyd's of London safety net underneath that risk decision. So there are a lot of employers that are fully insured who should be taking the risk of self-funding. And there are a lot of self-funded employers who know about but do not buy from facilities like mine. And the logjam is their consultant. The logjam is the broker or their consultant who advises them on all of these health coverage decisions, because the healthcare consultant or broker, and many of these are very large national firms that are publicly traded, the vast majority of the revenue comes not from the employer that they're ostensibly servicing, but it comes from the big insurance carriers and other vendors whose products they peddle. So the insurance broker will make recommendations to an employer, and he's the expert. You know, this is the direction you ought to go. And it's not because that's the direction the employer should go. It's that's what they recommend because that's who's paying them the most to recommend it. So there is a huge logjam, and it's the brokers and consultants. And the larger the firm, the larger the brokerage firm, in all likelihood, the more duplicitous they are, receiving all kind of backhanded and undisclosed revenue that the employer would never see.
Huh, that's very interesting. I know you have spoken on this, and we were talking about it before the interview. So it's typical in these sorts of discussions for even insiders like who know how the game is played. And they end up blaming, you know, big pharma, or, you know, it's these crony companies that are involved. And yet you know, you feel that that sometimes misses the true culprit behind all this.
Yeah, I would say that that is one feature of the Free Market Medical Association that that pervades the organization. Is we've as a group and as individuals have refused to be distracted by all the criminality of the cronies, because we all know Uncle Sam's driving the getaway car. I mean, none of these scams are operational without the favors that have been auctioned off in DC. And so when somebody from government shows up and says, "Hey, I love this Free Market Medical Association. You know, I'm from the government, and what now can I do to help you?" There's snickers and there's laugh and just ridicule in the room because we know that government has no role in the operation of a market except to get out of the way and to undo everything that they have done. So I think that it's very easy to become distracted and to find some champion in government who's a hero, you know, who's going to rescue us from all of this, when the real solution is for government to stop first doing everything that they're doing, and second, to undo everything that they have done, because any intervention represents a roadblock between a willing buyer and a willing seller. And there are many interventions, and some of them have been well-meaning, but most of them have just been favors auctioned off, I would argue, in D.C. And that process continues. I think that there are examples. I don't want to be too broad stroke. There are examples where government has gotten involved, and they've gotten involved in a very interesting way as a buyer. So rather than get involved with all kinds of new mandates, where, for instance, mandating price transparency, what a disaster. And we all know where that would lead. That would just lead to a redefinition of price transparency to suit the price gougers. So rather than do that, government, for instance, the county government here in Oklahoma, the largest county is Oklahoma County. And they decided they were going to exert their muscle as a buyer. So they have all of these employees, you know, that fix the roads and the water lines and all the stuff they do here in Oklahoma County. And the county government decided they were going to be self-funded, self-insured, number one. And number two, if any of their employees would patronize a facility like mine that had their prices posted online, they would pay the entire bill. So they would waive all copay and all deductible. And it's been very interesting because that has been price deflationary in Oklahoma City. They're a large enough buying group that in order not to lose them as customers, many of our competitors have said, "Listen, we'll match whatever pricing we have to in order not to lose this business." So government is a buyer. If government has to exist and it wants to do anything that's good, you know, it at least could use carrots instead of sticks, and you know, using dynamite like they typically do. I would say that pervasive in the membership of Free Market Medical Association is this concept that the real culprit in the disaster of the medical delivery system in the United States and the absence of the free market is Uncle Sam.
Yeah, I really like that perspective. And it's sort of analogous, Tom Woods and I, when we're talking about like the housing bubble and that thing, it's not to say that the things depicted like in the movie The Big Short are wrong. Like, yes, the ratings agencies were doing stuff, and there were certainly many Wall Street firms that were selling stuff that they knew was not very safe, and yet they were getting AAA rating and the banks doing the liar loans. But the point was, the only reason that whole system lasted so long was because the Fed was pumping in money, and then everybody gets bailed out of that on the other end. And, you know, and then there was all sorts of regulations preventing competition and things like that. So you see a similar thing here. I was recently, Keith, at Texas Tech, I was on a panel talking about prescription drug prices. And as you can imagine, I was pointing the finger at the FDA for a lot of the outrage in that sector. and some lady in the back got up, and, you know, she was, I think she was a faculty like in the medical sciences department or division. And she was telling me something about how in Japan they had developed these MRI machines that were much better than the ones they use in the U.S. And she was trying to use it to show the benefits of government, because I guess it was some government-funded, you know, research. And so when she was done, and I said, okay, you know, I don't know enough about this. You obviously are the expert on here, so let's just stipulate that those MRI machines really are much better for all the reasons you just said. Why don't they just use them here in the U.S.? And she said, oh, well, the FDA wouldn't let them in. You know, and not realizing the irony of what she just said there. So again, you do see that.
That's hilarious. You know, my introduction to the truth about the FDA was a Robert Higgs video, or on, I think it was a recording of a talk he gave called "The State Is Too Dangerous to Exist" or something like that. And he lines out, and you know, what the FDA really is up to and how they work and who controls them and all of the carnage that you would expect from a Higgs video.
Yeah, I know you know this, Keith, but just for listeners who might be new to this area. So one of the things that I developed with Doug McGuff, the ER doctor who was a co-author on The Prime Prescription, was in free market economic circles, normally the complaint against the FDA is, oh, they put up all these barriers to entry and all these hurdles. And so it just raises the price of new drugs so that, oh, yes, you know, it's the drugs that end up on the market are very safe relative to what would happen in a Wild West environment, but they're expensive. It's like, you know, like a law forcing everyone to drive Cadillacs or better that wouldn't necessarily be good for the average motorist, even though the people still driving after the dust settled are now in really nice cars. But actually, it's the worst of both worlds. So yeah, you do have that where, quote, safe drugs, even though there's no such thing as totally safe, but safe products end up being more expensive than they need to be. But you also get the flip side problem where if the FDA approves something and actually is quite dangerous, the public just says, oh, it must be safe because the government said so. And it can take years for the FDA to reverse itself, even as private organizations realize, no, they should never approve this thing. You know, and the Vioxx scandal being one of the primary examples of that.
Yeah, they can't seem to get it right on either side, either preventing bad drugs or you know, stopping good ones. It seems like it's all wrong.
Well, I suppose here, do you have any thoughts in terms of like over the next few years? So one thing that I haven't seen barely anybody talk about is the fact that my understanding is the Trump administration effectively repealed the Obamacare individual mandate in the sense of like they're not, the IRS is not going to penalize you for insurance coverage. On your end, like, is that true?
That is true. Effectively, it was an executive order where I believe they just said they were not going to enforce the tax penalties, and that can be undone with another election. So, what I know a lot of people are doing are buying insurance coverage, not unlike what I have, where there's a cost-sharing ministry. Because keep in mind, the Affordable Care Act exempted the cost-sharing ministry members. So the cost-sharing ministries are actually mentioned in the Affordable Care Act as membership in one of these organizations protects you from the teeth of the IRS in this law. So the safe play now is, I believe, belonging to one of these cost-sharing ministries and having some sort of an indemnity plan, perhaps, on top of that, like Philadelphia American. They're members of the Free Market Medical Association. They sell exactly that product. So, you know, even if there's, you know, another election and, you know, some new, more left-wing, progressive, issues their own executive order and, rescinds Trump's, you would still be in good shape. Having said that, in Vermont, Vermont now requires the purchase of health insurance by every resident of the state that's not covered by a federal plan, and cost-sharing ministries were not exempted. So if you live in the state of Vermont now and you belong to a cost-sharing ministry, you are in violation of the law if you don't buy instead of or in addition to that coverage from one of the carriers. So while Trump did basically render the law toothless, I think it's very unstable, and without some more deep repeal, I think that you always have to keep your eye on that, because this health lobby is it's large. It's bigger than all the other lobbies combined, including defense. And so there's a lot of money flying around, and people are very influenced, obviously, by this health lobby. And it's not a health lobby that's working for the good of the average patient or consumer.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, those are all great points. And yeah, I'm glad you did bring that up, because we didn't clarify that earlier, that these health sharing ministries are, they're legal. In other words, you're part of that, then that checks the box in terms of you having coverage according to the ACA. But where I was coming from is the whole point of the individual mandate was to prevent the death spiral, that, oh, if we're going to, you know, and make health insurers have to take anybody, even if you have brain cancer, then the only way for that to be financially feasible is if you make everybody buy health insurance. Like, the healthy people got to buy it too. So now, if technically they're not being forced to buy it, isn't that going to spell the death of conventional large insurance companies?
And I think that month to month, some of these large insurance carriers actually have shown some losses. And that's exactly right. With the mandate gone, but the pre-existing condition clause still there, that's bad for them. They still receive huge subsidies, though, from the federal government. And the one thing I've learned is when a hospital administrator or an insurance executive says that they're losing money and they're poor mouthing it, in all likelihood, that means they're making so much money, even they are embarrassed. So it's hard. It's hard to even know what's true.
Right, right. Well, what's funny on this issue, just to permit my own little complaint about Paul Krugman, who you may know, I'm not the world's biggest fan of. He, you know, for years, you know, in the lead up to the ACA and then even afterward, Krugman kept making this basic point that the ACA is like a three-legged stool. And if you're going to have universal coverage, then you have to have the essential health benefits and you got to have the individual mandate, because otherwise the whole thing falls apart. And so stop whining, you know, or, you know, those Republicans come along and they promise that they're going to give you all the goodies, but none of the broccoli. Don't believe them, because, you know, they don't know the first thing about healthcare economics. And then once Trump did that, you would expect Krugman to say, oh, the end is near. And instead he said, Nancy Pelosi did such a good job building the ACA, it can even withstand Trump's attempts to sabotage it.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable how his whole shtick went out the window the moment it was politically necessary. But ironically, I agree with the earlier Krugman that I thought, yeah, given the other elements of the ACA, the individual mandate was necessary. Otherwise, you know, it's just, you get this crazy situation where people who are sick can sign up for coverage and you got to cover them and the other people have the option. How in the long run is that going to work? Because the premiums are just going to keep rising, so they cover their costs from the last cycle, and that's going to make more and more healthy people say, why am I paying for this? This is crazy.
Yeah, that's what government does, though. You know, there's a flawed premise and they make a bad decision, and all they can do at that point is make even worse decisions subsequently. They won't go back. We'll go back to the premise.
Well, what I really like about what you're doing here with the FMMA, Keith, is, you know, you know, intellectually, you can sit there and explain to the, you know, the curious listener, here's what went wrong. Here's a, you know, a brief history of the government intervention. And the only long-term solution would be, of course, a return to more free market policies. But in the meantime, here's what you can do with your, you know, company or your family to sort of secede from this system and you know, kind of stand aside as the whole thing perhaps might come crashing down in the next couple decades. Am I putting words in your mouth, or is that one way you're looking at it?
No, that's exactly right. I use the word secession all the time to characterize exactly what we are promoting. Because most people fail to realize over half of the medical services purchased in the United States right now are socialized. And the only way to really act in a some sort of fiduciary way that's in your own interest is to unplug from that system and refuse to subsidize the whole disaster. So it really is, I think it is properly thought of as secession, and it's a disaster and it should be addressed. But in the meantime, there's some very easy, practical things that can be done, self-funding by employers. continue to listen to any advice that an employer receives from a consultant with a huge amount of skepticism. And having even said that, there is a movement in the United States amongst the healthcare consultants and brokers that has figured out that there is a market for honesty. And some of that was on display at the Free Market Medical Association as well. So, and the system is a mess, but I think the real message I want people to receive is there is a huge, very justifiable reason for optimism, because markets are really, really showing people in this country their power and what they can do, and it's very healthy. And the folks that have been saying for years, you know, this cannot be done, the free market and those principles cannot apply to this industry because there's so much uncertainty, they're being proven wrong every day. And it's a wonderful thing to see.
Well, on that optimistic note, I think that's probably a good point to wrap up this interview. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Keith Smith, and for all the work you've been doing. I'm sure the listeners are excited by what you're doing, and many of them may want to go take action.
Well, appreciate your having me, and for all of the work that you do, Bob, I'm a big fan.
Thanks so much. You're making me blush. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.